257. Every enhancement in the type man up to this point has been the work of an aristocratic society, and that's how it will always be over and over again. A society which believes in a long scale of rank ordering and differences in worth between man and man, and which, in some sense or other, requires slavery. Without the pathos of distance, the sort which grows out of the deeply rooted difference between the classes, out of the constant gazing outward and downward of the ruling caste on the subjects and work implements, and out of their equally sustained practice of obedience and command, holding down and holding at a distance, that other, more mysterious pathos would have no chance of growing at all. That longing for an ever-new widening of distances inside the soul itself, the development of ever higher, rarer, more distant, more expansive, more comprehensive states. In short, that very enhancement in the type man, the constant self-conquest of man, to cite a moral formula in a supra-moral sense. Of course, where the history of the origins of aristocratic society is concerned, and thus the precondition for that raising of the type man, we should not surrender to humanitarian illusions. Truth is hard. So without further consideration, let's admit to ourselves how up to this point every higher culture on earth has started. People with a still natural nature, barbarians in every dreadful sense of the word, predatory men still in possession of an unbroken power of the will and a desire for power, threw themselves on weaker, more civilized, more peaceful, perhaps trading or cattle-raising races, or on old, worn cultures, in which at that very moment the final forces of life were flaring up in a dazzling fireworks display of spirit and corruption. At the start, the noble caste has always been the barbarian caste. Its superiority has lain not primarily in physical might, but in spiritual power. It has been a matter of more complete human beings, which at every level also means more complete beasts. 258. Corruption, as the expression of the fact that within the instincts anarchy is threatening, and that the foundation of the effects, what we call life, has been shaken. According to the living structure in which it appears, corruption is something fundamentally different. When, for example, an aristocracy like France's at the start of the Revolution throws away its privileges with a sublime disgust and sacrifices itself to a dissipation of its moral feelings, this is corruption. Essentially, it was only the final act in that centuries-long corruption, thanks to which, step by step, it gave up its ruling authority and reduced itself to a function of the monarchy, finally even to the monarch's finery and display pieces. But the essential thing in a good and healthy aristocracy is that it feels itself not as a function, whether of a monarchy or of a community, but as its significance and highest justification. That it therefore, with good conscience, accepts the sacrifice of an enormous number of people, who for its sake must be oppressed and reduced to incomplete men, slaves, and instruments of work. Its fundamental belief must in fact be that the society should exist not for the sake of the society, but only as a base and framework on which an exceptional kind of nature can raise itself to its higher function and, in general, to a higher form of being, comparable to those heliotropic climbing plants on Java, people call them Sipo Matador, whose branches clutch an oak tree so much and for so long until finally, high over the tree but supported by it, they can unfold their crowns in the open light and make a display of their happiness. 259. Mutually refraining from wounding each other, from violence and from exploitation, and setting one's will on the same level as others, these can, in a certain crude sense, become good habits among individuals, if conditions exist for that, namely a real similarity in the quality of their power and their estimates of value, as well as their belonging together within a single body. However, as soon as people wanted to take this principle further, and, where possible, establish it as the basic principle of society, it immediately would show itself for what it is, as the willed denial of life, as the principle of disintegration and decay. Here we must think through to the basics and push away all sentimental weakness. Living itself is essentially appropriation from and wounding and overpowering strangers and weaker men, oppression, hardness, imposing one's own forms, annexing, and at the very least, in its mildest actions, exploitation. But why should we always use these precise words, which have from ancient times carried the stamp of a slanderous purpose? Even that body in which, as previously mentioned, the individuals deal with each other as equals, and that happens in every healthy aristocracy, must itself, if it is a living body and not dying out, do to other bodies all those things which the individuals in it refrain from doing to each other. It will have to be the living will to power. It will grow, grab things around it, pull to itself, and want to acquire predominance. Not because of some morality or immorality, but because it is alive, and because living is just the will to power. But in no point is the common consciousness of the European more reluctant to be instructed than here. Nowadays, people everywhere, even those in scientific disguises, are raving about the coming conditions of society from which the exploitative character is to have disappeared. To my ears, that sounds as if people had promised to invent a life which abstained from all organic functions. The exploitation is not part of a depraved or incomplete and primitive society. It belongs in the essential nature of what is living, as a basic organic function. It is a consequence of the real will to power, which is simply the will to live. Assuming that this is something new as a theory, it is, nonetheless, in reality, the fundamental fact of all history. We should at least be honest with ourselves to this extent.